May it please the court, my name is Randall Barron. I represent Mr. Golub. In this matter, I'd like to reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal, if I may. We are here to determine two issues that the court must review de novo. The question is whether or not plaintiff appellants have plausibly alleged that there are materially false or misleading statements in the merger proxy, and if so, whether or not defendants are nonetheless immune from liability under the PSLRA state safe harbor. To be clear, it is in our view, it is a simple case. There are fundamentally just two statements that we have raised as issues. We've broken them down a little bit within the complaint, and some of them are repeated more than once in the proxy, but the statements are fundamentally that which is set forth in paragraph 797E of our complaint, and that's ER 161, or the proxy statement at 43, where the board agreed that they needed Gigamon's best estimates of long-term financial outlook in order to properly assess the sale, and that they acknowledge that after an in-depth review of their long-term plans, that their prior long-term plan was the KB projections, but that the board determined that Gigamon's recent performance, and this is really the key, the recent performance clearly suggested that the KB projections overstated Gigamon's long-term prospects, and the board then determined that the KC projections appeared to better reflect. Adopting the KC projections over the KB projections fundamentally wiped out approximately $4.1 billion of revenue of this company and approximately $1.2 billion worth of cash flow, which was just enough to allow the bankers who did a fairness opinion to determine that this was a price within a fair value of the company. What the second statement is related to that, which is the more generalized statement that the board determined that the merger was fair and in the best interest of shareholders. And again, they did that based upon the investment bankers' valuation based on the KC projections. So again, that statement is again undermined by the very same facts that we set forth in our complaint. In our view, there are fundamentally three ways in which statements like this, which are a mixture of both opinion and some current or historical statements, can be found to be false or misleading under federal securities laws. The first is from under Virginia Bank Shares, is that the belief in the opinions, and that they, in this case, that KC is a better reflection and that the merger is fair, is not an earnestly held belief. The second, it comes from Omnicare sort of describing what Virginia Bankshares was talking about. And in that case, the Supreme Court said not only that liability can rest not only if the speaker did not hold the belief she professed, but also if the supporting facts she supplied were untrue. And again, the supporting facts in the statement was that things were so bad in the third quarter of 2017 that we now needed to shift from what was our agreed to plan and fundamentally drop out that $4+ billion of revenue. And finally, the third way that these statements can be found, or you can be liable for these statements, is under Omnicare, where even if you do genuinely believe the statement of your belief, that if there are omitted facts that would undermine that would show that there is a lack of basis for that belief, again, that would demonstrate that those statements are actionable, at least at the pleading stage. Here, what we have done is we have pled detailed facts in quotes, in fact, that show that all three of those attributes apply in this case. We have pled, and I'm not going to go through it in length, although it is in our complaint and in our briefing, that we have showed first that the company consistently said that they had their long-term prospects were great. They were saying that they were continuing to accelerate at anywhere from 32 to 41%. that they were growing far and away faster than anyone in the market. That's paragraph 46. That they were year after year getting better. That's paragraph 49. And most importantly, what we allege at paragraph 62 of our complaint is that in the third quarter itself, the very quarter in which the support for the belief is saying things got bad, they were saying that the bookings was increasing, was the strongest that they've seen in the last 3 years. That means while the revenue was not coming in, the source of that revenue was going up beyond where it had ever gone before, and that they have a good deal of confidence in there. So again, we're undermining both the belief and in fact the support for that belief. We also know that just some softness in the second and third quarter would not be enough to really justify that statement as well, because again, their own CEO, and this is a paragraph 81 of our complaint, made it very clear that the company did not look at a quarter by quarter basis. They understood that revenues may slip and slide between quarters, and the issue were the bookings and the growth, and that therefore the business was not quarter by quarter. In fact, he specifically said, we are not a quarter by quarter business, and that this is a long-term play. There is not a short-term window. And we also allege that the timing of that adjustment from the case B to case C was suspect. And again, if inferences are to be drawn in our favor, would demonstrate that they were not done for that, for the purpose of the softness in the second and third quarter. It was done because of the bid. In fact, we allege specifically that they continue to use the case B, and that the case B was discussed and the board met at least four times between this purported softness and the adjustment, where they never adjusted down to case B, and they only did so when the buyer, Elliott, who had bought into the company as an activist investor, made it best and final, and they needed a forecast that reduced by that $4.1 billion in order to get an opinion that says this was fair based upon their own internal valuations. And finally, we also allege that there wasn't a basis for that dramatic shift, right? That the shift that they had not only reduced the third quarter, but it took out some, you know, as we said, billions of dollars, reducing the revenues from $10.4 billion to $6.4 billion and cash flows from $2.1 billion to $905 million. So there was a significant reduction that, again, doesn't make sense for just a softness in a quarter. And this is where we allege specific omissions that would actually undermine that under Omnicare. And we said they omit the fact that they were in the midst, by the time they actually did the reduction, they were in the midst of a record fourth quarter, a fourth quarter that would have made up for the problems that they theoretically had in the second quarter.
Does the complaint or the record indicate what those fourth quarter results actually were?
No, we can't. We don't have that information. The company was no longer public. They never produced that. There is all we have, again, because we have to draw reasonable inferences in our favor, is their own statement that it was a record fourth quarter, that they indicated that there was the highest quarter of growth in Gigamon's entire existence. That was a quote that came from them in a representation to the public market. So we don't have those
numbers. What was the date of that representation?
That date was in the fourth quarter. Let me get that for you. May 2018. So again, what we know is that they were aware of that information. They had every basis to believe that the third quarter numbers were not a justification. And finally, our last omission is the fact that had we actually gotten the case B updated, remember they did the fairness opinion on case C updated. Had they provided that, they would have been able to show that they had adjusted for the softness in the second and third in the updated case B. They didn't need to double count, i.e. move both a adjustment for the second and third quarter, and then shift, do that seismic shift from case B to case C. I'm gonna say that defendants don't challenge the allegations as we make, they tried to make another argument, which is fundamentally that the facts of this case are different than what we say. That is directly in contrary to this court's opinion in Koha v. Orexigen Therapeutics that was issued in 2018. In fact, they did exactly the same thing. They're not saying that that our allegation that the softness didn't account for it. They're saying, no, we really had a lot of softness. And they did so again, much like in Koha, with 21 documents submitted, added to a complaint, 1,000 pages of documents and argument in support of that. None of that should support a grant of a motion to dismiss in this case, because we're not supposed to do that here. Finally, defendants make the argument that this is protected by the safe harbor, and that is significantly problematic. They do so without actually citing the current state of the law, which was what this court issued in Quality Systems, which is that when there are mixed statements of fact, and when there are mixed statements of fact and law, or forward-looking statements and current statements, that you still look, that those are not protected. Here we are talking about the current statements of what was the company's current belief, what was the current support for that belief at the time they issued, because again, we don't know. What we do know from Quality Systems is that the idea is that we have forward-looking statements if there's predictions of revenue and earnings over time, and those aren't borne out. We don't know whether or not those projections were borne out, other than in the fourth period we know things were good, but that's not the issue. The issue is, did they have the value at the time? And finally, I think what is most important, and also comes from Quality Systems, is that the if there are cautionary language, it needs to be precise and meaningful. As Quality Systems noted, it says, in order for it to work, you fundamentally have to admit your own violation in order to have a meaningful cautionary language. What they did here was provided shareholders with the same boilerplate language that the same lawyers used in six different merger proxies at the very same time. You cannot just simply cut and paste meaningful cautionary language, or that would undercut the entirety of the need for meaningful cautionary language. I'd like to reserve the last couple of minutes, if I may, unless I have any questions, Your Honor.
I guess not. So reserve your 2 minutes, 19 seconds.
All right, thank you.
May it please the court, good morning. Jerome Byrne for the Gigamon defendants. I will be speaking for 12 minutes and then sharing time with Mr. Lutz, who will speak for 3 minutes. Gigamon here did not violate Section 14A by making a false or misleading statement in the proxy statement that was sent to the shareholders seeking their vote for the Elliott acquisition. I think it's important to start by noting this is not a merger case. We're not here debating the merits of the court's decision, simply a disclosure case under 14A. It's a very false or misleading statement made in the proxy statement. And Judge Oreck's very well-reasoned and thoughtful decision provides two straightforward grounds for affirmance, which I'd like to address. First, the safe harbor here covers this case because all the challenge statements are forward-looking. Second, I'd like to address the Virginia Bankshares standard. There are no well-pled facts, as required by the Private Securities Litigation Reform Act, showing that what the board said was objectively or subjectively false. That's independent from the safe harbor argument. And finally, counsel did mention omissions and Omnicare. I think it's very important, I will get to that at the end, but to stress that this court has never held that a pure omissions case can be made under 14A. Indeed, in Omnicare, Justice Kagan noted that Virginia Bankshares still sets the standard, and the statute is different under 14A. It requires something to have rendered a false statement in the proxy. Let me turn to the safe harbor. Counsel's argument, I believe, is effectively conceded. We're talking about forward-looking statements. The statements are that the board's projections were not the right projections, or different projections should have been used. The reply brief at pages 16 to 17 make this absolutely clear. They note that, now paraphrase, the case B projections overstated.
Well, counsel, some of them, at least two of the misrepresentation. One is not a forward-looking statement, right? It says the proxy statement informs shareholders that our board of directors unanimously determined that the merger is fair to and in the best interest of the company. That's not forward-looking. That's a present fact.
Your Honor, actually, I think it should be interpreted to be forward-looking. There's no dispute that the board, in fact, reached that result. And in saying that we believe the merger is fair, the rest of the statement goes on to say it's fair based upon the forecasts that we believe are going to come true. So it's saying this is fair because we think this is going to happen.
Presently fair. Maybe at most it's mixed.
Well, I actually would, Your Honor, I would suggest that it really is forward-looking because the fairness is that, in fact, we believe this is going to come through. It's the same thing when someone makes a forecast. The implicit in that statement is the belief that the forecast is going to come true. Same thing as saying, I believe this is a fair forecast. The safe harbor really isn't written, the statute, to mince words about that. And what really distinguishes this case from Quality Systems that counsel referenced is that there are no present tense facts that are alleged to be false. Counsel has embraced many different facts stated by the company at widely disparate points in time in the year leading up to the merger. But unlike in Quality Systems, they don't claim those are false facts. They claim those are true, and that undermines the forecast.
It demonstrates subjective falsity because the statements leading up to the actual merger and going private, acquisition by Elliott, were all rosy and they belie and included such things as, and this is a quarter by quarter company, we only look at things quarter, you shouldn't look at things quarter by quarter, we look at the long term. And so some of those statements actually belie what the board was saying in the proxy statement, and therefore it undermines the subjective falsity. I mean, it supports the subjective falsity of the statements in the proxy statement.
So, Aaron, let me address that and go to address the objective and subjective falsity, because there are some facts here that are absolutely not in dispute. The company's results for the four quarters leading up to the merger are not in dispute, and they were poor, declining consistent four quarters of misperformance.
Quarter two and quarter three were actually below expectations.
Quarter four of 2016 was the beginning of the disappointment when the growth rates declined dramatically from over 40% to 20%. Quarter one was essentially flat, and then the company missed its expectations for Q2 badly, and Q3 badly, much to its surprise. I mean,
not quite as bad as Q2, though, right?
Well, it depends on how you measure badly. They were down 8% below what they expected in Q3, believing Q3 was going to look good, 3% growth. It was 5% down. I would note that significantly surprising because in that time frame, they were talking to Elliott, and they rebuffed Elliott's at that point and said, we think actually Q3 could turn out well, and they got surprised again. So you have the situation of a company consistently missing four straight quarters leading up to an acquisition. It's reasonable to say the board should be pretty skeptical of where the business is going. One important point I do want to make is for all the reference to these positive statements, the plaintiffs have taken them completely out of the context of time, and that matters. And I would point to the very first sentence of their reply brief where they refer to, and I'll pull the snippets, that the company was, quote, growing by far and away the fastest in the market, or, quote, record pipeline, or, quote, glide path to continued growth. These statements were made over the course of different points in time and during an entire year, and that matters.
So Let me ask you a question, Mr.
Yes.
Byrne.
Yes.
Who stood to benefit from having a depressed stock price at the time of the going private transaction?
Who stood to benefit from having a depressed stock price? I don't know that anyone stood to benefit from a depressed stock price. I don't.
Elliot, but Elliot didn't make the statements in the proxy statement, right?
Well, Your Honor, I mean, yeah, one can always say that if the price of the company is lower than.
Why can't you answer my question in a straightforward manner? You know the answer to it.
Well, Your Honor, I guess the answer is sure the buyer would benefit from it, but right. It doesn't mean.
And who else? Anyone else in the board, on the board, perhaps the CEO?
Well, there's no allegations that anyone benefited.
Oh, I'm just wondering.
Have equity.
Whether there, it's a legitimate question. I mean, in assessing a subjective falsity, why would, you know, who would have the incentive to actually project a lower stock price than what they believed was true?
But Your Honor, I don't think management and the board have an incentive for a lower stock price, because to the extent they hold equity, a declining business and a declining stock price hurts them too.
Right. So, except, and that's correct. I agree with you. Not perhaps not all management, right? I mean, if you're going to be the CEO before and the CEO after, and in between you have record the record business, and after it's private, so no one will know what it is.
Well, I'm sorry, go ahead.
No, it's okay. I'm just trying to, you know, I'm look at the plausibility of this whole thing.
Well, no, there's always a possibility that someone could say, there's always a possibility someone could say, well, the management or the board sold out too quickly. But you must look at the context of this company that's objective and not disputed going in, which is a rapid decline in the business. And let me address the Q4 point that Your Honor raised, because there is no evidence that there was a Q4 record that was different than what was projected by updated Case C that the board relied on. And that's a very important point.
Well, that the board relied on? Yes, I agree.
Updated
that's a different question.
Yes, Your Honor. Updated C was what the board proposed to the shareholders as their estimate. That forecast projected a record fourth quarter. So the statement in May, when the company said we've hit a record close, as Judge Orrick noted, that's consistent with updated Case C. There's no evidence that anything projected by updated B, or which was frankly a draft that the board never got very far on, a preliminary estimate before they went with updated Case C, there's no evidence that the board actually achieved what the plaintiffs say was achieved. There's no basis for that finding. It wasn't as if updated C that went to the shareholders was projecting this company is dead in the water. It was projecting growth of over 27% for the next year. So when you look at the entire, you can always ask who has a motive to do what, but when you look at the board at that point in time, after multiple quarters of declining performance and disappointment, reevaluating after a very surprising third quarter, what should we do with our forecast? Not only is that protected by the safe harbor, in my opinion, but there's no basis to show that that's false. Because
what's your response to his contention that the timing of the shift by the board from B to C is something that supports an inference? What's your response to that argument?
Your Honor, thank you for asking. I have really a few responses. One is it ignores the shocking disappointment of the Q3 results. And if you look at that timing, as late as mid-September, the company said no to Elliott. We're not interested. We actually think Q3 is going to be okay. So they said no. So that's important to consider. And then the proxy lays out, which is not disputed, shortly after the September quarter closed, the board learned of the shocking, surprising results. So there are cases that point that is the intervening event. The board was justified in saying, you told us management 3 weeks ago we were going to be have a great quarter and should say no to Elliott. And now we're down. We're 8% off what you thought in the last 2 weeks. So that's an important intervening event, along with the fact that there's no evidence that the company was jumping at the Elliott acquisition. It had twice said no. In May, it had said no, thinking Q2 was going to be good. And in September, again, they had said no, thinking Q3 was going to be good. So there's no sudden change that is inexplicable. You have a business in decline. And I want to emphasize the updated C projections were not for a flat, dead company. Strong growth into the next year, strong growth going forward, but just not as robust growth as updated B.
So the allegation, or at least the argument, is that the transaction took place in the middle of Q4, and that the board and others involved in the transaction team were aware of that Q4 would be good. They were getting information at that time that would belie the updated C projections upon which they relied.
So, Your Honor, there is no well-pled fact showing what was known at that point in time. There's nothing to show that what was known was different from what updated case C was showing. And a point I would make that's important is it's not just about Q4. Q4 was a record supposed to be under updated C or under B. It's not about Q4, it's about the overall projection. So for the plaintiffs to show objective or subjective falsity, they would have to say that somehow the Q4 interim results were so much better than what was expected that the board should have thought the company was going to jump up on the trajectories back up to rapid growth under updated case B. And there's nothing to show that. All the plaintiffs have said is that the board might have grown, I think, 102 to 106 versus 93, which was in the updated case C projections. So there's no basis for that. And, you know, recent history is important here. The board had, as I mentioned, had said no to Elliott. I'm mindful of my time for Mr. Lutz. Had said no to Elliott twice before, thinking midstream of Q2 and Q3 results were going to be okay. And in fact, they were not, and they were surprised. So there's no basis to conclude that mid-December, they must have known that the quarter was heading off to record levels beyond what was predicted.
Can you address your point, which you alluded to earlier, that the Omnicare standards do not apply in a 14A case?
Yes, Judge Collins. 14A under this court's DeSegador case has always required a misstatement as to in a proxy statement. So if there is an omission, it must render misleading something in a proxy statement itself, a statement. Omnicare addressed the Section 11, and in this court's interpreted to apply to 10B area. But Justice Kagan's decision notes that the standard under 14A, which is a different statute, Virginia Bankshire still applies. So you still need to tether you. It's not enough to say there is a pure omission out there. It must be tethered specifically to a misstatement, alleged misstatement in the proxy. With that, I'm sorry, Mr. Lutz, I have taken up more time than expected.
It's okay. I'll just be, just a note on the waiver. Mr. Barron didn't respond to it. That the law is clear in the Ninth Circuit that when a claim is dismissed with leave to amend and then the plaintiff does not amend the complaint to add that claim back, it's waived and cannot be appealed. I see my time is up, but that issue is very clear under Ninth Circuit law.
Well, yeah, I'll give you a couple minutes to say what you wanted to say.
Sure. No, I appreciate that. I mean, that's the summary. I mean, in this case, the law is clear in the Ninth Circuit that a claim that is not, that the claim has been waived here. The plaintiffs filed an original complaint that named that Elliott with a single claim under Section 20A, a control person claim. The district court dismissed that claim and granted leave to amend. Plaintiff filed an amended complaint but chose not to assert that claim or any claim against the Elliott defendants. The law under the Lacey v. Maricopa County case and other cases that have followed it in the Ninth Circuit is clear that when claims are dismissed without prejudice and then not repleted, those claims are waived and cannot be subject to appeal. They can't be appealed. Plaintiff's only response is in our view, not a credible one. And they say on page 29 of their reply brief that they didn't voluntarily dismiss their claims against the Elliott defendants. That is just not correct. All of the cases that we've relied on and cited to in our briefing make clear that this is exactly what plaintiff did when it was given the opportunity, but chose not to replead its claim against the Elliott. So under clear Ninth Circuit law, that claim was waived. Thank you.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Lutz. Mr. Barron?
Just for 1 second, when we're told by the court that they're dismissed with prejudice, our interpretation is the court dismissed them. We have no choice, and we would actually be in trouble for actually pleading it. Let me focus on, though, Mr. Burns' argument, because it is exactly what this court said in Koha, which is, quote, if defendants are permitted to present their own version of the facts at the pleading stage, and the district courts accept those facts as uncontroverted and true, it becomes near impossible for even the most aggrieved plaintiff to demonstrate a sufficient plausible claim to relief. And that's what he's done. He says they're not disputed. They are. We are disputing that the second and the third quarter were problematic. We are specifically pleading that in June, he said growth in the business continued to accelerate. In November of 2016, we are growing by far and away the fastest in the market. In May 16, 2017, the CFO said the company has grown 40% per year, every year since its founding, except for one. So it looks pretty good on the chart. In July 27, 2017, this is in the middle of the third quarter, he said quarterly growth in bookings was the strongest that we have seen in the last 3 years, and the increasing interest in our broad portfolio of the world of securities products provides us with a good deal of confidence regarding our future. Again, they are saying exactly the opposite. That is what
Mr. Barron, isn't it a fact that the Q2 and Q3 results were not as good as expectations and fell below what they thought?
That is a fact, but that is not just because your numbers don't. Remember the way that results work, and indeed the CEO said it, this is not an industry in which you get all the money in at the same time. The key to this industry is your bookings. And things get delayed. Sometimes stuff gets pushed into the fourth quarter, gets pushed into the following first quarter. That is not an indication of growth. There is no statement that Mr. Burns presents or otherwise in which the company says, no, we were no longer growing in the second and third quarter the way we believed we were growing. It said that their earnings and revenues had barely missed, and it wasn't significant misses, had barely missed. And you can't say it was a devastating fourth quarter or third quarter because that A isn't what we plead, and B, it was something that was made up and could have been made up in the fourth quarter by the end of the year. But at the pleading stage, you have to accept our allegations. You can't accept Mr. Burns' arguments, because if that were a case, you could never plead it, because they would just flood the record with documents and say, no, accept our inferences over plaintiffs.
All right.
If there's any other questions, I'd be happy to answer them.
Does anyone have any other questions? No. All right. Thank you very much, counsel. Golub versus Gigamon will be submitted, and this session of the court is adjourned for today. Thank you.
This court for this session stands adjourned.